This is the second in a series that we've been hosting on trying to understand power geometry in the Gulf. And the nuclear agreement has changed the landscape, and we're trying to understand what that means. We had Ambassador Taiga here for the first session. I'm delighted that Jim Mattis is here in the second session. On our third session, we're going to have Lisa Anderson, who's the former president of American University in Cairo and is currently the dean of Columbia University School of International Public Affairs. So I will announce that to you when that happens. I hope you'll all join us for that as well. You're all here because you know Jim Mattis. So for me to take time to introduce Jim Mattis would be wasting your time and keeping you from hearing him. Probably one of the most remarkable officers I've ever had the privilege of working with. He was the executive secretary at the time when I was the comptroller. And people don't know the executive secretary, that's the lymphatic system, that parallels the circulatory system in the background. It's hugely underappreciated and really is that glue that holds us together. So us civilians don't look as dumb as we are when we have to get together. Jim was the architect and the master of keeping the executive secretary working, both for Secretary Perry and for Secretary Cohen. We got to meet at that stage, and then we've had many opportunities since then. Just delighted and honored that he's here. He's on his way to the Gulf, and so he gave us the privilege of stopping off just for a little bit of time to talk with us to try to understand what is going on. I must say, it feels very jittery to me to have we've got some kind of parallelism between Iran and Syria, Iran and Saudi Arabia, long-standing allies that are all of a sudden being put side by side with countries that have been opponents for quite a while. This is a very curious time, and I think we're going to need to listen carefully to a man as wise as Jim Mattis to understand. How should we be thinking about this? So can I ask you, with your warm applause, say thank you to Jim Mattis for him coming to be with us today. Thank you, Dr. Henry. And to be here today with you, ladies and gentlemen, with Jim Mattis, former Deputy Secretary of Defense, in the room, obviously, can be a little bit intimidating, except for Anchor Talk. Outside this town, that someone good is listening here to the good Starting in 2010, to jump forward again, Secretary of State Clinton orchestrated broad international economic pressure on Iran, and the goal was, very bluntly, to force Iran to come to the negotiating table and to come under an internationally supervised non-military nuclear program. In 2013, President Rouhani was elected, supposedly a moderate. I read in some circles, I'm hard-pressed to use that word because I think it lacks definition when you talk about people approved to run for office by the supreme leader in Iran. Basically, his government, though Rouhani's government, negotiated the interim nuclear agreement, and the JCPOA is the result, and formal implementation actually began in mid-January of this year. For example, they removed the enriched uranium, sent it out of country. We all know that. But at the same time, besides what Iran was doing, the United Nations rescinded seven prior United Nations Security Council resolutions that imposed economic sanctions. Now, supposedly, their removal was subject to immediate reimposition in the event of, and I quote here, significant non-performance by Iran, unquote. So the relief was given on those UNSCRs based on a pause in one program, but the money they were given to go into a number of other programs, and now we find why in the region, from Tel Aviv to Riyadh to Abu Dhabi, we have a difference of opinion between the Arab and Israeli view of this agreement and the American view, because Iran has five military threats. One is the latent threat of the nuclear weapons program. Another one is the counter-maritime program. You all remember we're going to put mines in the water. We have coastal defense cruise missiles, board ships, and impound them, that sort of thing. The next is the ballistic missile threat, which they've been very obvious about what they're doing at send out its enriched uranium, 25,000 pounds, and remains the single most belligerent actor in the Middle East, and is the commander in CENTCOM with countries like Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen. Every morning I woke up and the first three questions I had were, had to do with Iran and Iran and Iran. Their consistent behavior since 1979 through today shows no sign of changing. In fact, I think the State Department has characterized it well when they said they have actually picked up their tempo of operations. The ballistic missile test being one, they have also conducted cyber attacks on the United States, resulting in 7 U.S. indictments. They have doubled down on support to Assad's murderous regime, and they are very much aware, they are keenly aware, that if Assad falls, that's the biggest strategic setback in 30 years for the mullahs there in Tehran. They've increased the flow of arms, ladies and gentlemen, into Saudi Arabia, explosives into Bahrain, and arms into Yemen. In fact, in the last 3 months, February, March, and April, the French Navy, the Australian Navy, the U.S. Navy have all seized arms shipments each month. And if anyone's ever flown over that area of the world and you see the hundreds of vessels on any given day at sea carrying commerce, smugglers, smuggling is legitimate out in that part of the world, as you know, and others going on, the idea that we're catching all the arms shipments, that's a flight of fantasy. We certainly are not catching them all, and there's nobody in the intelligence services or the navies, I think, that say so. The Republican Guard commander has openly boasted of Tehran's control over four capitals, Beirut, Damascus, Baghdad, and Sana'a. And I think he was oops on Sana'a because then Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates led the GCC forces in there, and clearly that has not gone according to plan. Hopefully the UN brokered negotiations in Kuwait that started today will put an end to that, but also ensure that Iran is kept out of there and the bubble and dot, the choke point coming into the Red Sea. Bahrain and Jordan have been specifically targeted, publicly targeted by the Quds Force commander, our old friend Soleimani, who's openly calling for the annexation of Bahrain. And by the way, Bahrain, to many in Iran, is not just the island. It's also the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. The Republican Guard General proposes erasing Israel off the map. Sounds familiar. It is, because it's what they've been saying for a good many decades. And the Supreme Leader, I think, summed it up very well when he said, those who say that the future lies in negotiation, not in missiles, are either ignorant or traitors. That is the Supreme Leader. I think we should take him at his word. That's what he believes. And when President Obama, trying to keep this effort alive, when President Obama characterized Iran regime's responses to the JCPOA as respecting the letter but violating the spirit of the agreement, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, General Firvez Abadi, contemptuously said, we've studied the details of the nuclear agreement, quote, and we don't have any information about its spirit. That's about as abrupt a slap in the face to any effort on our side to try to be fair brokers on this as you can come up with. And I could say, I can go on, by the way, I don't want to bore you here, but that ends, I think, for now, any moderate Iranian response. So where is the U.S. right now? The U.S. is in a strategy-free mode. Washington is confused, I believe, and not invested in strategy. We are shifting our focus from one region or sub-region to another. We remember the pivot to the Pacific, left our friends in the Middle East and Europe very concerned. That kind of word is seldom used in strategy. It might make good operational thinking, but I don't think it's a good idea on a strategic level for a country with worldwide responsibilities. You remember we were very concerned about Crimea. We're not concerned about it anymore. Now it's the Eastern Donetsk Basin in eastern Ukraine. We've been attacking ISIS in Iraq a little bit. Then we shifted to Syria. Then we're at a gradual escalation right now. The Senkaku Islands, then with the Spratly Islands and the Paracels. I'm not trying to get off track here, but my point is that we've got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And it appears that we're going with a hit-and-miss approach that is us constantly shooting behind the duck. So the JCPOA, coming back to the arms agreement, that's all it was. It was designed to increase stability and decrease proliferation.
say that for a sitting U.S. president to see our allies as freeloaders is nuts. And but you know what was happening? I was telling Dr. Henry upstairs, I worked out one morning. I was on my machine, and I saw this Goldberg article come across. I saw his long, so I hit my print button, went back, got on the machine, was working a little bit, went back. And I was both laying down, and I pulled the stuff off the printer, and I started reading. That's real, you know, kind of scan, you know, before you do something. With a highlighter and all. And at first, there's my administrative incompetence that was demonstrated so clearly to Secretary Perry and Secretary Cohen long ago. I somehow got something that Trump said stuck inside something that President Obama said. I said, how did I do that? I went back through it. It wasn't Trump. It was the president saying that our allies were free riders and that sort of thing. And I would just tell you that I'm going to be surprised if Prime Minister Cameron would ever speak to our president again. I would also say I'm going to be surprised if President Obama has proven right in his trying to make this effort work with a regime that's holding hostage the Iranian people. And I think that somehow people, we all live on hope. We're all men and women. We all hope for something better tomorrow, better for our children. And I think that thinking that or hoping that Iran is on the cusp of becoming a modern, responsible nation is simply a bridge too far. And if nothing else, we need to have an insurance policy here. But why would we sign up? Another reason would be maybe it's the best we could get. I was in a meeting late one night with one of our partners in the Gulf. And when it was done, he asked for the staffs to leave, and he and I sitting alone. And he said to me, ladies and gentlemen, he said, it must be a very long table. I'm looking at what he's talking about here. He said, well, you know, I keep hearing that the military option is on the table just a couple of years before the agreement. And he said, it must be a very long table because I was squinting and I couldn't see it on the table, so I got my binoculars out. And they said, it must be a very long table because I cannot see the military option. He was joshing me, and I knew him well enough for many, many years in the region that we could be that open with one another. But the bottom line is, I think from Washington to Brussels, from London to Tehran, Abu Dhabi to Tel Aviv, the idea that the U.S. would go into one more fight in the Middle East at this point in time was probably just not in the cards. And so maybe if we were in that kind of a situation, maybe this agreement was the best we could come up with. A third possible reason is maybe the folks in the American administration think that the moderates can win. I think you have to be careful on that. It goes back to whether the economic self-interest can grow strong enough. But remember, at the same time, the security forces are going to be getting stronger as well with the infusion of money. And they have proven themselves quite capable, the coercive forces, of keeping the people in line there using beatings, imprisonment, rape, and other things that we have witnessed them using in the recent past. And I think, too, that time it would take for the economic policies to take root and to turn over a new mood in Tehran amongst the leaders may take quite some time. So, again, why do we need an insurance policy to get through this period? I think that the imperfect yet intrusive UNIAEA inspection regime is not perfect, but it is intrusive. And I've read the agreement twice, 156 pages long, 159, something like that. But on 30-some pages, I've heard just like names of people who were pulled off the sanction list. Not all that intimidating, actually. But if you read through that, it is very clearly drawn up with the expectation that Iran will cheat. I mean, when you read this, that's the sense you get from the other nations that forced those issues. So if nothing else, we'll have better targeting data should it come to a fight at some point in the future. But I think that in terms of both strengthening America's global standing among European and Middle Eastern nations alike, the sense is that America has become somewhat irrelevant in the Middle East, and we certainly have the least influence in 40 years. So on the way ahead, we're just going to have to recognize that we have an imperfect arms control agreement. Second to what we achieved was a nuclear pause, not a nuclear halt. We're going to have to plan for the worst. The old military adage, hope for the best, but plan for the worst, comes to bear. And in light of the other four threats 6 more fighters in. I'll send another reinforced special forces company of 150 special forces, well-trained, fully kitted out, ready to go fight under your command. Again, ladies and gentlemen, you can't find allies like that if you don't stand by them in their difficulties. So they may not be perfect. If we're waiting for perfect allies, we're going to be awfully alone in this world. And but what I've seen in our own country, we're not perfect ourselves. So let's figure a way to work together. Let me stop there and then open time for questions. Thank you.
Colonel Dennis, thank you very much for that presentation. I'm John Alterman. I'm the Senior Vice President, Emergency Chair in Global Security and Geo Strategy, and the Director of the Middle East Program. I have a few questions before we go to the audience, which is already champing at the bit. One question. Talked about Iran's asymmetric threats in the region and their activities supporting terrorism, supporting hostile states. Was it a mistake to make a nuclear agreement and seem to take the focus off the other activities in the region? Because, as you know, many of our Gulf allies say the nuclear issue isn't our issue. As a former foreign minister in the Gulf told me, if somebody already has a gun pointed at your head, it doesn't matter if they have a cannon pointed at your back. Was the whole approach to put so much effort on the nuclear program and non-proliferation a mistake for U.S. interests in the Middle East?
The short answer is no, it was not a mistake. In this town, we seem to have forgotten the tremendous effort that went into nuclear non-proliferation in decades past. I'm sure it's going to be to our regret, and especially to our children's regret, we did not maintain that focus. So I think in the case of Iran, it was not a mistake to engage on the nuclear issue, even if they were to give it primacy. That, I think, is debatable, but even there, I wouldn't say it's a mistake. The mistake would be to implement it in such a way that we appear to take our eye off the other ball. That's the mistake, and that's a choice, and that's a choice we did not have to make. So there's a way to balance this in terms of creating more stability in the region. Unfortunately, we probably have not executed in that manner yet. I mean, it's still subject to a choice every day on our government.
About 8 years ago, a presidential candidate named Hillary Clinton suggested extending a nuclear umbrella to GCC allies against Iran. Do you think that's something we should consider under what circumstances? If so, under what circumstances should we pursue?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I worked with a gentleman by the name of George Schultz out of Hoover. And he calls us, he walks in every morning that we're out there, and he calls us younger officers in, and only at Hoover would I be one of the younger officers. And he talks about what it was like coming home from World War II as a Marine in the Pacific. And that generation looking around at 50, 60, 70 million dead, economic privation all over the world. And the greatest generation is called that for a reason. They say, we're part of this world, whether we like it or not. No more going back, point out on the League of Nations. They create the United Nations so we can talk. They create Bretton Woods so we don't have economic conditions that are going to drive us into depression and war again. They, 3 years after that terrible war against the Nazis and the fanatic Pacific War, the Marshall Plan is passed, and we are actually helping our former foes recover. I mean, could you do that today? I don't know. But most importantly, the United States makes what the Australian ambassador to Washington told me one time here a couple years ago, the single most self-sacrificial act in the history of the world. I think, what is that? You have to look at it through a non-American's eyes. He said, you could have turned your back on Europe after two world wars and said, we're going with the Middle East and Asia, we're going with South America, we're done with you guys. Instead, the American presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, Democrat and Republican say, and the Congress, working together in a nonpartisan way,
many other issues. We can't ignore them when they've got serious issues. And a third would be security. Are we really so long from 9/11 that we've forgotten what it was like? Even to look over at the Pentagon with smoke pouring out of it, and I'd suggest we're not that far removed from it. No nation on its own can provide security in this world. No nation in a globalized world, actually ever, but certainly not today, can do this on its own. So if we're going to have them stand by us, if we're going to try and stop maniacs from attacking us again, like on 9/11, then we better be working with the folks in the region and look out for our own interests. Go beyond the moral to the strategic again.
There's one last question before I go to the audience. I get their questions ready. As you know, everybody in Washington is talking about budget constraints.
Yeah.
Is there anything we're doing in the Middle East now in the security field that you think we can afford not to do anymore? You've talked a lot about plussing up. You've talked about building relationships. Is there anything we can stop doing that we're doing now?
You know, worth more than 10 battleships or 5 armored divisions is the sense of American political resolve. I think the more resolution we show, the more unity we show with our allies. Certainly, we have to do some ourselves. Even a farm boy or farm girl knows if you want to pump water out of a water pump, you have to put some primate water in first to get an airlock to bring it up. The idea that we can tell others, here, you do all the fighting, and we're going to sit back and be up above. We'll give you intelligence. We'll fly overhead with restrictive rules of engagement, and you do all the dirty work. Probably isn't going to work. So I think that we could probably get more from our allies instead of grudgingly or belatedly doing things that need to be done, but being more forthcoming on it and holding constant high-level discussions. Keep remember, any coalition against the kind of enemy we're up against takes two pieces. It's got a political piece and it's got a military. The political is dominant. The military piece is subordinate and hopefully acting in accordance with that political agreement. And right now, I think lacking that kind of political coherence at the top, we're having to do some things that I wouldn't have to do if we could show more firmness and more conviction in what we're doing. All the troops on the ground are, they're just the front for what stands behind them. And without a unified Congress, a unified American position with our allies, that is a much weaker front than it would be with that sort of support.
So is there Syria? Any other way to apply that to our strategy in Syria right now?
Yes, I think get the political coalition put together up front, make clear where we stand on it. And it doesn't mean 100,000 troops for 10 years are doing nothing. It means using strategy and figuring out how to go forward.
Thank you. Okay. You can start on that on the right back, sir.
Thank you very much. And thank you, General, for your remarks. John Getty from Newsmax and Newsmax Television, and I guess I'll point to the elephant in the room. General, you have been mentioned so often, very much like your fellow scholar soldier James Gavin was a generation ago, to run for president either as a Republican or as an independent. Have you given any thought to it, and how serious are the rumors about it?
No, I haven't given any thought to it.
How serious are the rumors?
Like you know that better than I do.
Sorry, huh? Okay. Yes, I'm in the blue shirt now.
Thank you very much, General Mattis. It's the second time I'm listening to your first time at UN Heritage. I am Dr. Bisaj Chaudhary with Parks and Recreation. There's a lot of criticism inside USA, as well as there's criticism about this nuclear deal, even inside Iran. And could you tell us what was the compulsion pressures on the parties which were negotiating that they had to come up with a complete and safe deal with so many loopholes? And if this deal collapses, what happens next?
Thank you.
about the military relation with Egypt, and do you recommend the resumption of the Black Star military exercise?
Egypt is a very, very interesting case. One third of the Arab peoples live there. It has been an ally. It broke with the Soviet Union. It has been an ally since. It has fought alongside us in Desert Storm. It has maintained the security of the Suez Canal, a vital waterway. You put all this together, and Israel has gone through very tough times. And they did have a democratically elected President Morsi. Egypt had a democratically elected President Morsi. He was basically thrown out, I believe, by a public impeachment that the military then shouldered him aside, and then President el-Sisi came in. Obviously, we're concerned about any political system has to have a counterweight, and whether or not there is a sufficient allowance for legitimate political dissent. That said, right now, the only way to support Egypt's maturation as a country with civil society, with the money to support President el-Sisi, we should have Red Star reinstituted, perhaps not with tank battles, but with counterterrorism type training, that sort of thing. But I think that when a president comes out 2 years in a row at Al-Azhar University calling for a revolution in rhetoric, the amount of negatives about the Muslim religion, I think it's time for us to support him and take our own side in this. I'm a strong believer that Egypt is a critical nation in terms of the future for stability in the Middle East.
To serve under you as a command sergeant for the Office of Security Cooperation. And I want to ask you a question, sir. Given what you mentioned about Iran and influencing foreign capitals, and given our engagement in Iraq, how do you see us walking the rope between supporting the Iraqi government with the significant Iranian influence in the global fight against ISIS, sir?
It's a very tough situation. When I was once complaining about my job, as I did routinely, in the laptop, matter of fact, I once was asked by the Vice President jokingly, you know where you got the job, Jim? I said, no, Mr. Vice President, I wondered. He said, because we couldn't find out dumb enough to take it. So I was complaining about one time, and a former Prime Minister in Europe said, hey, Jim, if you can't ride two horses in the circus and get out in the middle of the circus, you know, welcome to reality. One of my last visits to Iraq, I heard the same message from a number of people in the government, in the Shia-led government, and it was, help us avoid the suffocating embrace of Iran. So I think there is a way to work with Iraq where we do not decide to just cast Iraq off because we've all read about it enough, heard about it enough, it's got enough complexity, just be done with it. I think in this case, what we're doing right now in Iraq, while it may not be sufficient, is certainly on the right path.
Yeah, so again, all the way on the aisle at the end. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Linda Bernstein, Sputnik International News. Question about U.S. presence in the region. You seem to indicate that more of a naval presence would be the way to go to reassure allies. I'd just like you to elaborate on that. And when you look at increasing the U.S. presence, whether at sea or on the ground, combined with more U.S. weapons going to allies,
said earlier that a coalition has two elements, political and military. Every one of those navies, matter of fact, I was even looking for Antarctica to see if they get a penguin there. They said about all the continents aligned here, you know. Basically, all those navies work together under the command and the coordination of the only navy in the world that could have drawn all those nations together. They all work together practicing clearing mines from the Persian Gulf, Arab Gulf. And the result was that after a couple of years, about a year later, they realized, I think they're wrong, they were actually creating an international coalition against them. How much have you heard? By the way, it's gone up as high as 39 nations now involved in the annual international anti-mine exercise. I think there is a way that, to answer your question, if you use that example, and then you can apply it wherever, so long as what we're doing is trying to stabilize the situation.
We have time for one more question, yes, sir.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, Mark Thompson, Time Magazine. General, it's been more than 3 months since Iran seized 10 of our sailors and held them overnight. A lot of Americans have forgotten the Navy's report still is not finished. But the sailors came home safe. Iran, of course, is used for propaganda purposes. So who won in that clash?
Thank you very much.